As we've heard from Dave Politis in the previous appearances here on this program, the disappearances that he has focused on have occurred mostly on land, a lot of them on water, and as we will learn tonight, some of them in the air. So Phil Collins might have been onto something. Maybe there is something in the air, because a few of these cases are pretty weird. When we come back, though, we're going to jump into some of the more recent research he's done about disappearances right on the land, and this first one is a chilling example. We'll be right back. Dave Politis, let's jump into the case of Carol Turner. This is pretty creepy. What did you learn?
So for people who don't know, national monuments are part of the National Park Service. That's their property, and they patrol it, and their National Park Police are there. Well, there's a location called Organ, O-R-G-A-N, Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument. And it's in Arizona, far southern part of the state, right near the border with Mexico. Well, on February 3rd, 1971, a woman, 32 years old, named Carol Turner, who was a student at the University of New Mexico, drove there and was going to take a few days vacation and break from school and kind of walk around. She was inquisitive, smart, athletic, brilliant, some people called her. Well, I stumbled onto this case and saw it in some archives somewhere, and I immediately wrote to the Pima County Sheriff and asked them for any documents on the case. I got the documents in my hand, then I called the National Park Service at Organ Pipe and asked them for their reports, and they stated, we don't have any. I said, have you heard of the case? No. Well, this person's still missing. So she was a 32-year-old graduate student. She had been a PE teacher with a master's degree in physical education, decided she wanted to go back and get two more master's degrees. And she was just really admired by all of the faculty that she worked around and studied under. And all of the articles and all the reports said that they stated she was really smart. Well, she was about to graduate with a degree in zoology and biology, and she was working as a university lab tech to earn some extra money. She loved the outdoors, hiked regularly. On January 31st, 71, she left her residence in southeast Albuquerque. She was driving her white 68 Plymouth station wagon, and she went about an eight-hour drive to the monument, and she slept in her car that first night. February 1st, it was established that she attended an evening ranger presentation. At the end of that presentation, she went up to the ranger, engaged him in conversation. He remembered it and said, hey, she asked really good questions and was smart. February 2nd, she went to the Park Visitor Center, spoke to a ranger there stating she had just returned from a hike to Bull Pasture, and asked about a guided trip to a place called Dripping Springs. Subsequent investigation found she spoke to a ranger, an individual named Larry Henderson. He said he remembers her, asked good questions, was interested in the environment, wanted to know where to go to see more things. Well, on February 3rd, she moved her car out of the campground. Nobody knew exactly why. And on February 4th, at 9:15 a.m., a ranger was patrolling and found Carol's car parked in Estes Canyon picnic site with a note taped inside the windshield. And it said, if I'm not back by 4:30 p.m. on February 3rd, please contact the ranger.
Smart. Smart thing to do.
Exactly. No, I wish everybody would do that. But then as I went through this, I started to think she was going to a place and she was heading to a place that she'd went to earlier. And I always wondered in the back of my mind, did something happen that first trip? And she was going back the second time, and just in case she was leaving this note, I wasn't sure. So he parked his patrol vehicle, and he hiked the 2 miles up from Bull Pasture. He saw nothing and decided to check the trail register, and it was signed by Carol the first day she went on February 2nd. He notifies park headquarters, advises them that he has a missing hiker, and this starts the search process. February 4th and 5th, the National Park Service sent in 2 four-man teams up that trail to search. The weather was described in reports as cold and blistery. They determined Carol was last seen eating an orange on the trail, and they did find some spare orange peels scattered around. the Pima County Sheriff was asked to join the search when the National Park Service started to get low on resources. They also called in the Border Patrol and the Tribal Police, U.S. Customs, Monthan Air Force Base. They brought in civilian helicopters. It was massive, the search effort. 300 ground searchers were on at any one time. The park superintendent, a guy named Matt Ryan, contacted Carol's parents in North Carolina. The parents stated that Carol would never, ever go off trail. She was in outstanding athletic condition, and she was supposed to be back in Albuquerque on February 5th. February 22nd, Matt Ryan told the Associated Press, "It's almost becoming a search for the answer to a mystery." March 7th, one last push to locate Carol. Rangers claimed to smell an odor of human decaying flesh up the trail. March 13th, National Park Service put a team into the area of the odor and found nothing. And again, they have no documentation on the incident anywhere. Now, I did get this NPS report that was in the Pima County documents, and it was written by the chief ranger, Rothwell Broyles. And it was three typewritten pages that outlines the search for Carol, and 90% of it, real boring, real mundane. But I'll read you what it says. One additional clue was turned up on Monday, February 15th. At two limited locations about 400 yards apart, on the southwest facing of the Ajos, A-J-O-S, a very strong and distinct human odor was found, but at no other locations. Supervising Ranger Hal Cross of Saguaro, that's the Saguaro National Monument, and one other searcher who was recently involved in the recovery of a body had very strong and positive feelings on the identification of the odor. The following day, Ranger Cross, after flying the area in a Border Patrol plane, led an 8-man search party back over this area. Again, the odor was observed at the same location, but only occasionally and not as distinct. Other members of the team described it as a very weird and scary. All efforts were negative, and search activities have been reduced to intermittent patrols at this time. I have never, in thousands of reports, seen anything described in a National Park Service report as very weird and scary.
So why these guys, like that? That's really strange. Just a feeling they had, or the fact that they're smelling what they think is decaying human flesh, but there's no source for the odor.
Well, here's what it says. Other members of the team described it as a very weird and scary. So I'm sure all of us who spent time in the outdoors have smelled the odor of dead flesh, decaying. Sometimes animals die. You smell it. I don't know if that could be weird and scary. But again, this was her second hike into that area. Was she nervous about making the trip? Is that why she left the note? Or was she just smart about it? They never found her. There was never any subsequent follow-ups after that first 60-day search. Both of her parents are deceased. She didn't have any brothers or sisters. There's nothing left of her family anymore.
You have another case in the book about a land disappearance that involves a really smart person, somebody who's headed for what looks like great things. His name is Stephen Reed, and this disappearance was in 1999 in Oregon. Tell me about that one.
So this is the one time out of the thousands of times where I read this case and I said, you know, I'm going to go against my own protocol. I'm going to call the parents. And I'm glad I did. But Stephen Reed, missing June 23rd, 1999, the Salmon Butte Trailhead outside of Sandy, Oregon, about 7 miles southwest of Mount Hood. And for people who don't know, a lot of disappearances around Mount Hood that I've written about before. He was 24 years old. He's an intellect, super smart kid, was a third-year medical student. The reports come from the Clackamas County Sheriff. And when he was 12 years old, as a gift for his birthday, he asked his parents for the book called Grey's Anatomy. Kind of tells you where his head was at. He knew he was going to be a doctor when he grew up. He graduated from Albion College with a biology degree, Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude. He was accepted to Wayne State Medical School. First year of medical school, he was granted an internship to the Mayo Clinic. In June of 1999, at the end of his second year, going into his third year, he took his first vacation in 8 years. And he traveled to Oregon to check into some possible residency. And so he was kind of mixing business with pleasure. He told the family he wanted to see some wildlife. Mother told her son at the time never to hike alone. Please don't do that, Stephen. On June 19th, he flew into Portland International Airport, got a vehicle from Rent-A-Wreck, a Chevrolet Cavalier, drove to a Portland youth hostel, checked in, and paid cash for 13 nights. I'm sorry, paid 13 nights with his credit card. Now, law enforcement reports state on June 20th, Stephen called his parents on his borrowed cell phone from them, stated he had arrived, all was well, checked in, things were great. Manager of the hotel stated Stephen usually left before the others woke. He was last seen on June 22nd or the 23rd, and he was seen at night in a suit saying that the residency interviews had gone really well and he was happy. On June 22nd, he drove his vehicle from the hostel to the Salmon Huckleberry Wilderness, 25 miles southeast of Portland, and completed a trail permit to enter the Salmon Butte Wilderness. And I stop people here right now and tell you that you may think that when you complete those trail permits and put them in that little metal box, that somebody's reading those and is going to follow up and make sure that you come out. Those trail permits are never reviewed, and they're only used to see the load of people on the trail. They're never checked to see if you came out. They're essentially worthless, so don't ever count on those. But on June 23rd, a pair of hikers saw Stephen's car at the trailhead early in the morning and believed it had to be a day hiker, but they were there really early. Well, they exited the trail later that day, and they still saw the car there, and it bothered them. And they felt so strongly that something was wrong that they called the sheriff. And a deputy came out, ran the registration on the Rent-A-Wreck, and the vehicle came back registered to a family. And the registration hadn't been turned over to Rent-A-Wreck yet, so the deputy left a message on the machine of the family who still owned the car on the registration system, and he left. Well, Stephen was supposed to return to Detroit on July 2nd, and parents were at the airport, and he didn't arrive. Well, they called the Portland police, tried to file a missing persons report, and they were told that you couldn't file a missing persons report unless you were there in person.
Hmm. Wow.
So the next day, Hope and Larry got on a plane and flew to Portland. And the search and rescue finally got down the trail and obtained some assistance from the National Guard, canines, and SAR teams. Searchers faced rain and wet conditions for many of the days. But again, the search didn't start for days after he really went missing. And Hope and Larry praised the attitude of the volunteer searchers, but stated that they were highly disappointed in the deputies. They stated that the search didn't last long and was terminated without finding anything. Cadaver dogs were later put into that area, never picked up a scent. They had a psychic approach them, and the psychic went with them and some Forest Service people down the trail. They came to a switchback, looked down the cliff. They saw a little teepee structure made of little trees lying on the ground. And they said that down there you'll find Stephen's glasses, and that's where he died. Search and rescue went down there, but they didn't bring their metal detector. And the psychic said you needed that to find it, but they never found it. Nothing was ever found there. And they Hope and Larry said that they hadn't had any communications with the sheriff in years, none ever with the Forest Service. Stephen's never been found. Starting a search almost 2 weeks after the disappearance is a very, very difficult task. And right here I'll say that Carol Turner, when she disappeared in her park, she at least left a message on the inside of her car indicating when she was going to be out. Now, I say this at every conference, and I say it on every time I'm on with you. People need to carry a personal locator beacon. They cost about $200, $250. There's no monthly service fee. You can get them on Amazon. You activate it. It sends a signal to a satellite. that someone needs help immediately. They'll find you within 8 feet. They dispatch search and rescue. I carry one every time I go out. And I would say that probably 95% of these cases could be quickly remedied if everyone carried one of these.
Well, a whole lot of things went wrong in this case. Just a comedy of errors. It's not very comedic, though. I mean, but, you know, a search that starts that late, you don't have much of a chance of succeeding, do you?
I don't think you do. First of all, he wasn't real acclimated to the area, didn't understand the dangers, probably wasn't dressed for success, probably didn't have a backpack with him. I doubt if he even had a geological survey map of the region. But when you go in an area like this, there's so many things that can happen. I mean, I tell people that you could go down this trail, and if it's a trail that isn't very active, you could be on the trail 5 or 6 miles down and break your leg on the trail and die on the trail. And don't think that hasn't happened, because it has. And something very simple like this can just ruin your life when you could just have this little device that could save your life.
You mentioned about the psychic that got involved in this case. Have you ever employed the services of a psychic, or have you ever investigated a case where a psychic was used and they provided information that turned out to be accurate?
I'll tell you a story. There's a remote viewer who's on coast to coast fairly frequently. He will go unnamed. But he claimed, and he contacted me, that he could find missing people. And I asked him if he had ever found anybody, and he gave me the name of this person. And I listened to him, and I said, okay, I'll give you a case. And during that week that I didn't talk to him, I contacted this victim's wife. And I said, hey, did this person help you in finding your husband? And she goes, he didn't do anything. He never found him. He never gave me any valuable information. My husband was found on other means by other searchers doing other things, blah, 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 on and on. George, I'm a guy that has a really open mind, and I will use anybody. But when somebody lies to me, I won't use them ever again. And that person blatantly lied to me. And in other remote viewing cases, there was one guy I did a conference with a couple years ago, really nice guy. And the information he gave me wasn't even close in the realm of possible. Now, there's another guy who's a remote viewer that I'm trying to work with right now. Hopefully he's better. But as far as psychics, I did a conference in LA about 2 years ago, and there were 7 or 8 psychics all in this row at this outside area at the conference. And towards the end, I walked down this row, introduced myself to every one of these psychics, said what I did, what I could use their services for. And each one of them said, yeah, we want to help. We want to help for sure. Yeah, we could do this. I emailed each one of them the next week when I got back, and I never got a response from one of them.
Well, we're talking with Dave Politis about his newest book, Missing 411, Land, Air, Water. Our conversation with David Politis about his latest book, Missing 411, Land, Air, Water. The air cases are something different, a departure for Dave, and they are featured in this book. He focuses on aerial triangles that seem to coincide with the clusters on the ground. People literally vanish into thin air, and we're going to get to some of those in just a bit here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Dave, I want to jump around a little bit to make sure we save some time to talk about the air cases. So I want to jump into one of the most baffling cases involving water. It's a guy named Henry McCabe, and this is really pretty creepy.
That is a creepy case, and it's in New Brighton, Minnesota. It's a community just north of Minneapolis, not very far, almost a suburb. September 7th, 2015, 2:28 a.m. it happened. McCabe was 32 years old. So he was an immigrant from Liberia, married to a woman named Kareen. They had 2 kids. He lived in a city called Moundsview, again, just north of Minneapolis, north side. This is a cluster area of missing people that I've written about in the past. He had a great job. He was an auditor for the state of Minnesota for their Department of Revenue. Well, on September 6, 2015, his wife with kids went to California, and it was a planned vacation. Well, on that Sunday night, Henry went out with a longtime friend. He was a very diligent guy, always on time, very respectable. And he and his friend went to the club early. They left early on that Monday morning. Henry's friend states that he dropped him off at a location in Fridley at the Super gas station at 73rd Avenue. At 2:23 a.m., Henry's phone appears to have pocket-dialed his wife while she was asleep in California and left a lengthy voicemail of strange sounds, screaming, pains, growls, etc. And it's hard to determine when you listen to it if they're all human sounds or they're animal sounds or what are they.
We have a recording of a news report that was done based on this, and it includes some of the clips from that phone call. So maybe we could play that right now, and then on the other side, you can tell me a little bit more about it.
It's a voicemail unlike anything you've ever heard before. There are 2 minutes worth of noises, bizarre ones, but very little actual talking. Authorities confirmed the disturbing middle-of-the-night call came from Henry McCabe's cell phone. It was Labor Day, September 7th at 2:28 in the morning. McCabe's worried wife heard the message.
His and my cell phone connected.
Minnesota Community Policing Services is a nonprofit agency. It acts as a go-between with police and the Liberian community. The leader is trying to help the family make some sense of this recording.
The growls turned to high-pitched moans.
Like he's moaning in pain.
Like moaning in pain.
The tortured grunts suddenly stop. There is silence. Then someone, either Henry or another person, says, "Stop it."
I try to picture where he was, what it might have been like, what circumstances would have made him sound like that.
The voicemail is in stark contrast to other articulate recordings of McCabe speaking at an event. He's a state auditor.
What is the justification? What is the right thing to do?
The message is one piece of evidence Moundsview police are reviewing. The police chief tells me even the FBI is analyzing the recording and voices for clues. The chief says the investigation took deputies here on Tuesday to Rice Creek Park, which borders New Brighton, Moundsview, and Fridley, all areas where McCabe was reported seen or a cell phone ping placed him. Ramsey County Water Patrol searched but came up empty.
So that's a news report from a Minneapolis television station. The reporter mentioned in that report, Dave, that the FBI was analyzing it. The police were trying to make some sense of it. Have you ever seen any of that analysis or reports, or did they come to any kind of conclusion what the heck that was?
Never. It clammed up so tight. But one thing I've written about in past books is that the FBI follows these cases. There's no reason for the FBI to be involved in this. It's a local jurisdiction, missing person, that's it. Why is the FBI sticking their nose in this unless they are interested in it for some other reason? Now, the last tower that they pinged that phone was near Silver Lake Road at Mississippi Street in New Brighton, 1 mile east of the Mississippi River. And many of the cases I've written about in the past in Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, dealt with men, very healthy men, that were found in bodies of water many times in the Mississippi. When this happened, I thought, he's going to be found in the Mississippi or in something else really close. Well, the location where he was eventually found was searched multiple times, canines, helicopters, ground teams, everything. Well, on November 2nd, this is almost 2 months after he disappeared, at 4:20 in the afternoon, a kayaker was on Rush Lake, 1 mile southeast of the last time they pinged that phone, and they saw a body in the water and they recovered it. There was no violence at all to the body, according to the coroner. The determination on the cause of death was freshwater drowning. This area had been searched multiple times, and the FBI had that recording for analysis. Why was Henry McCabe in the water? Now, one of the things that I presented in Sobering Coincidence about all of these young, healthy men was that many times the families did not accept the determination by the coroner on the cause of death, and they paid for a secondary autopsy. Several times when they did the second autopsy, they found very high levels of GHB in the system of the victim. And they were in levels so high it didn't make sense. So GHB is commonly known as that date rape drug. People get it, they pass out, they realize that they're awake, but they can't move and they can't react. And if you think about this, many of the times that these people have disappeared, never has any of their friends, relatives, etc., seen the point where they disappeared. Sometimes they disappeared amongst friends. They couldn't explain how they got from point A to point B. Canines couldn't track point to point. A lot of times it happened in the winter and there was no marks in the snow point to point. And if you think what GHB does to you, it puts you in that state where you realize what's happening to you, but you can't react. So if they laid you, say, in a bank of snow, you would die from hypothermia. You wouldn't die from GHB intoxication. If they placed you in water, you would die by drowning, not from GHB. And you see, GHB is not one of the 26 drugs that are screened routinely by coroners across the United States. It's only caught if you pay an extra amount to do this much more advanced screening for drugs. And so it's very, very rarely, if ever, found in systems because most people can't afford a second autopsy. And I'm not saying that that is what is in all of these cases, but it showed up too many times to be ignored.
That recording, it certainly seems like he realizes he's in trouble or pain or agony. And then, as the reporter mentioned, it sounds like there's somebody else there that says, stop it. That's difficult to get your head around.
It is. And in many of the other cases I've written about that are related to these water, unbelievably, the victim is on the phone as they are going through this transition of disappearing. One time, not far from where this incident happened, a college kid's walking down the street. He's on the phone with a girlfriend of his and says, where are you? I need you here now. I need you here now. Phone cuts off. He's found days later in the Mississippi River. Another time, a kid in western Minnesota is missing, and his parents are trying to find him. And he's on the phone with him, and he goes, I don't know where I am, blah, 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 blah. Boom. Phone goes dead. He was never found, yet his car was found. So these incidents that happen where they're on their cell phone is something new and different. But when you listen to the incident as it evolves, it's very uncomfortable.
I mean, it seems like they're being abducted, kidnapped. And sometimes the bodies are found and sometimes they aren't. And they're just like snatched by persons unknown, by things unknown, almost like, you know, a gigantic bird is swooping down and snatching them up. You know, it's so many questions that
it
raises.
People calling me all the time and saying, well, you know, we talked about this earlier. I heard you on this YouTube say this is, well, I don't say that. And I want people to understand that this is not a conspiracy theory topic because I'm not giving you any theories. I'm giving you all facts. And that's the way I want people to understand this, is that it's an unusual topic that's tied together the way an FBI profiler would profile a series of crimes. We're linking together a series of facts to show that there's continuity here.
That there are patterns. And this book, I wouldn't think that you'd have cases in the air that would qualify under your criteria, but you do. You have a bunch of them. And it starts with looking at triangles, including one that's here in Nevada, right?
Unfortunately, yeah. Had you ever heard of that?
Yes. There was a pretty famous plane crash up in that area Steve, I'm trying to remember the name, Fosse, I think it is.
Yeah.
That got a lot of attention a couple of years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was, they did a massive search for him, and there was some weirdness that went along with that disappearance as well. When they eventually found him, they said it was bad air, and et cetera. But yeah, the people who don't know, there's a series of triangles around the world. And in the book, I talk about the Alaska Triangle, Bermuda Triangle, Great Lakes in Michigan and Nevada. And the way I got onto this was, there's some people out there in the world that are much smarter than me that have read these books and have put together some very interesting factual side notes. And a guy from Finland did some amazing work, sent me this booklet of things that he did. And in there he said, Dave, did you know that there's 6 major disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle that match dates of disappearances in your books? I go, I never even knew that. And I went back through it, and he was right. And that got me to start paying attention to these triangles. Now, in the Nevada Triangle, down there by you, it goes from Reno, Las Vegas, to Fresno. That's the triangle. And when I first got onto that, I thought, well, this seems kind of hocus-pocus. I don't know if I should pay attention. But then I put it on a map. I said, holy crap. You know, it's in the middle of that triangle. It's Yosemite Yes. National Park.
Yes.
I go, that's quite a coincidence. So Yosemite, Kings Canyon, and Sequoia National Parks are there. And I've got tons of disappearances in King Canyon and Sequoia as well. And when I watched a documentary about the Nevada Triangle, there's several thousand planes that have crashed and disappeared in the Sierras in that area. And a lot of it can be explained by various meteorologists as strange air currents and things, which seems reasonable. But when you bring into account that there's also many, many people that have disappeared in that area under unexplained circumstances, it seems kind of a strange coincidence.
Well, let's get into some. Do you have any specifics from the Nevada Triangle you want to get into, or should we just go jump into the cases of air disappearances in general?
Yeah, let's just go to air disappearances.
You have a case in the book from Moffett Field, Sunnyvale, California, from 1942. What's the deal on that one?
So that's a. I grew up not far from Moffett Field in Sunnyvale. I grew up in Cupertino, and I had planes flying into Moffett Field going right over my house every day of the week. And it had notoriety in the early 40s for being a place where all the blimps that patrolled the coast of California, that's where they were stationed at, there in Treasure Island in the middle of the bay. Well, on August 16th, 1942, a blimp was getting sent out of Treasure Island where they held the World's Fair. It was manned by Lieutenant Ernest Cody, 27 years old, and Ensign Charles McAdams, 38 years old. And they left Treasure Island, no big deal, general patrol. All the details on this came from the Navy file under a Freedom of Information Act I filed. Fascinating report on this. Well, as they depart, they start to head out over the Golden Gate, and they start to go out over the Pacific towards the Farallon Islands. And Cody was at the controls of an L-8 airship. And this was originally taken by our military, and it was owned by Goodyear. And they took it because it was needed for patrol. Well, both men lived near Moffett Field in Mountain View, but they drove up to Treasure Island for the day to leave on their ship. That night, water vapor was in the air, and it made the ship too heavy to carry a normal third person that would be in the bucket. They only left with two. The first 110 minutes of the flight was normal. In fact, there was no communication. And then at 7:50 a.m., the crew radioed that they were investigating a suspicious oil slick, and they were 5 miles east of the Farallon Islands. At 8:05, numerous attempts by radio to reach the crew, but there was no luck. And the Navy scrambled 2 OS-2U Kingfisher aircraft out of Alameda Naval Air Station to go track down the blimp. Well, the planes encountered cloudy weather with a ceiling of 500 feet. They decided it was too dangerous to fly below the clouds, so they flew above them. At 10:45 a.m., Moffett Field receives a call from Fort Funston near the Golden Gate stating that they had a L-8 ship with two pilots, and all were fine. Well, the Navy made a huge sigh of relief, and they felt that all was okay. Now, this was a really, really weird call, but it was in the file, and they couldn't explain why it was there. And then at 11:15, Fort Funston calls Moffett Field again, stating that, an L-8 had crashed in the hills of Daly City. Daly City is just south of San Francisco on the coast. Well, the Navy responds to Daly City, and they find their airship on the ground with one bomb missing. The gondola is in near perfect condition. Both motors on the ship were off, even though one throttle was half open and the other was all the way open. And the crew, which was required to wear life preservers over the water, both of the life preservers that they were supposed to be wearing were gone. There was a confidential Navy briefcase in each airship, and that was still intact. The cabin door was open. Plenty of fuel was in the tanks. The radio was in perfect condition. No distress call. Fort Funston called back and said they made a serious mistake. No L-8 was present at the fort. They couldn't explain why they made that original call. The central coast of California had a major search that started almost immediately. The Navy found two fishing boats and a Navy boat and a Coast Guard ship that saw the blimp dip and drop two flares on the oil slick. The blimp then gained altitude and disappeared into the clouds. They said all appeared fairly normal, but it did go into the clouds and disappeared. The crash happened at 432 Bellevue Street in Daly City, 3 miles east of the Pacific Ocean. The crew did not use parachutes, and the chutes that were in the craft were still there.
There's a couple of theories that – I'm sorry to interrupt you. There's a couple of theories that developed, and the theories are just about as weird as the disappearances. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to jump into the other details about this case and then – get your take on what might have happened to these two missing crew people.